This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. U.S. forces have begun to withdraw from Syria. That announcement came today in a week that has seen the Secretary of State visit countries across the Middle East. Elsewhere, North Korea's leader spends 3 days in China. Trade talks between China and the U.S. continue. And Congo, a country that's two-thirds the size of Europe, has a new leader. But his surprise appointment has been called an electoral coup. Plenty to discuss this week on the Friday News Roundup. And joining us here in studio are David Lawler, World News Editor for Axios. David, welcome.
Great to be here.
Joyce Karam, Washington correspondent for The National. Joyce, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Sean Donnan, senior writer at Bloomberg News. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Wonderful to be here.
We welcome your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories from around the world. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page where you can watch our video stream, or tweet us at 1A. Let's begin with Syria, where, according to a military spokesman, the U.S. has begun withdrawing troops. Today's announcement comes after an array of mixed signals from the president and his officials and some pretty heavy pushback from the region. David Lawler, let me start with you. Let's back up for just a moment. Remind us how we got to this point, how we got to where now troops are starting to leave, U.S. troops are starting to leave Syria.
Right. So we heard almost out of nowhere from President Trump that the U.S. was going to pull out of Syria. He said at the time, they're all leaving and they're leaving now. That eventually got pushed back to maybe a 1 month withdrawal, then perhaps 4 months. So the timeline has moved off. And we've also heard conditions from some of President Trump's advisors about the conditions under which the U.S. will pull out. And then this today, we hear that they actually are beginning this process. So there's been very little transparency in how exactly this withdrawal is going to happen. But this, I guess, is phase one.
So we're not entirely clear on kind of what the landscape looks like right now on the ground.
Right. I don't think we're clear at all about that.
Joyce?
I mean, totally what David is saying. This only adds to the state of confusion about what the U.S. is doing in Syria. Just on Tuesday, we heard John Bolton, lay out conditions for withdrawal. On Friday, the Wall Street Journal reported that actually the Pentagon does not take orders from Bolton, who is still in the Middle East. Pompeo just yesterday in his Cairo speech said when the U.S. Retreats, chaos follows. So in the region, there is a level of uncertainty about who is calling the shots in the administration. Is the U.S. really leaving Syria? What is the U.S. leaving behind in Syria? I mean, right now the situation is kind of stalemate, but when the U.S. leaves, there is much anxiety, especially among the Kurdish population, what will happen over there. Turkey has sent reinforcements to the border, and Russia is not even sure that the U.S. is leaving. There is no diplomatic framework for this. There are no negotiations. It's an abrupt withdrawal that was, came out in a 5 a.m. tweet by the U.S. president.
With regards to the Kurds, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo kind of went out of his way on Wednesday to reassure them, or the Kurdish forces in Syria, that they'll be safe after the American troops withdraw. Here's part of what Secretary Pompeo said.
These have been folks that have fought with us, and it's important that we do everything we can to ensure that those folks that fought with us are protected. And Erdogan has made commitments. He understands that. I think he uses the language he talks about. He has no beef with the Kurds. We want to make sure that that's the case.
It was Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking on Wednesday. Sean?
I think it's important to go back to the president's original tweet where he was claiming victory over ISIS as well. And one of the things that we've seen in the week since that tweet is a kind of walking back of that, a realization that actually, if there is a withdrawal from Syria, it's going to be a more deliberate one. They're eager not to leave a vacuum. We've heard that over and over again from the White House and the Pentagon. And one of the telling things in this announcement today on the withdrawal is that there is absolutely no mention of a timeline. And there is the details just are missing. So there's an announcement that this thing is going to be beginning. We don't know if it's one person coming home or if it's more of the 2,000 troops who are there now coming home.
Glad to get some of your comments on the Syria troop withdrawal. Sandby wrote on our website, the1a.org, U.S. troops withdraw from Syria, power vacuum opens up, other armies rush to fill the void. Totally predictable and totally stupid. David, who do we expect might fill that power vacuum? These other armies that were rushing to fill the void, Syria, Bashar al-Assad, yes. Is Turkey the primary second concern in terms of who would fill that power vacuum?
If you're talking about eastern Syria, which is the part where the northeastern Syria, where the U.S. was sort of guaranteeing the security of the Kurdish forces that are holding that part of the country, that is really where the void will open up when the U.S. leaves. And the question is whether Assad then rushes in and reclaims control over the whole country, whether the Turks then come in. These Kurdish fighters there are considered enemies by Erdogan and Turkey. So do the Turks come in and try and take that space? Or can the Kurds find a way to hold it and retain their autonomy there? So those are the broad possibilities. It'll likely be a combination of multiple of those, I guess.
We're speaking to David Lawler, world news editor at Axios, Joyce Karam, Washington correspondent for The National, and Sean Donnan, a senior writer at Bloomberg News. We welcome your questions and thoughts about this or any of the other big stories around the world that caught your attention. 1A@WAMU.org. And yes, we will speak about the situation at the southern border momentarily, but any of the big stories from around the world, we welcome your questions and thoughts. 1A@WAMU.org. Virginia emailed, "We cannot betray the Kurds again. They are our faithful allies." Joyce, what about Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan? What has he had to say about all of this, particularly the concerns about the Kurds there?
I mean, for Erdogan, they view many of the Kurdish militants there as terrorists. They'd like to go in and take control of this area. But when you ask, you know, who is capitalizing on this situation, to me, it's clear it's the Russians. You know, we saw a Kurdish delegation go on a secret trip to Moscow. Another delegation canceled their trip this week to Washington. You're seeing mixed signals from the U.S. to its Kurdish allies. So it's really unclear, but I think because of Russia's influence in Syria, its proximity with the Assad regime, and its long friendship also with the Kurds, it might jump in ahead of Turkey to take advantage of, complete state of confusion in the U.S. planning and timeline.
Sean, are there other players on the ground in Syria who might fill nominally the role that the U.S. played? Any of our allies who kind of see the Syria situation the way that the U.S. sees it? I mean, I'm just wondering about this, the use of the term power vacuum, this idea that there will be no one else on the ground but the Assad regime, ISIS, the Kurds, the Turks, like the people who are already in that region. Is there anyone else there on the ground?
Yeah, so we should back up just a little bit here. The U.S. has 2,000 troops in Syria. They're largely in a support, kind of an advisory role. This is not battalion after battalion of American troops who are holding territory. They're helping the Kurds. They're advising the Kurds. They're helping provide air support and so on. That's all very important. But these are not, there are not tens of thousands of American troops on the ground here. First point to remember. Second point is the administration really wants to see people like the Saudis and some of the Gulf states step up and take a bigger role in this conflict in supporting the troops on the ground. They also want to stop the Iranians from getting involved in a bigger way on the side of the Assad regime. It's a big, complicated mess. And the vacuum is not going to be a simple zero sum one. There are going to be all sorts of players. The point, I think, is not that Donald Trump is leaving a power vacuum behind, but that he's pulling out in a way that is only going to make the mess worse.
One more comment about the situation in Syria. Ace Karate commented, "I don't understand the logic of Pompeo's speech. He says things fall apart when the U.S. leaves a place, and that's what could happen. He blames Obama implicitly for ISIS and forgets the threat of the removal of Saddam Hussein and the destruction of the Iraqi regime by Bush, or whatever our view of it, led to ISIS." One more story with regards to Turkey, Joyce, that we wanted to talk about before we moved on, and this has to do with a player for the New York Knicks who's got some concerns over Turkey's president. What's that about?
Right. The NBA star, Enes Kanter, he canceled a trip to London to play with the Knicks because he's feeling he's getting death threats from Turkey. What he says, his father is an academic, is facing jail in Turkey. So what he is saying is because of his support for Fethullah Gulen, the guy in exile in Pennsylvania, he is being threatened by Erdogan because he is critical of Erdogan on social media. Just yesterday, a Turkish journalist got sentenced for 1 year in Turkey for exposing the tax havens in Malta and that investigation. So this fits very much with the narrative of shrinking freedom of expression, not just in Turkey, but in the larger Middle East. Turkey today is the second or the first, actually, biggest jailer of journalists, and it's very much cracking down on dissent. And I'm not sure how credible his fears of assassination are, but the mood is out there, and I think he's taking precautions. He said he would only go to New York, but not to not overseas.
Press freedom is something we also want to talk about as we continue with the Friday News Roundup with Joyce Karam, Washington correspondent for The National, Sean Donnan of Bloomberg News, and David Lawler of Axios. One more comment about Turkey from Michael, who emailed, Erdogan gave assurances to Trump that our Kurdish allies would not be attacked in their phone conversation. When Bolton asked Erdogan to put that in writing, he resisted. Trump considers Erdogan's word his bond and will hold him accountable if he doesn't hold true to his promise. Love to get some reactions to Michael's comment when we come back and continue with the Friday News Roundup. We'll talk more about the very, very busy week that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has had touring the Middle East, and we'll get to some more of your questions and thoughts as well. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with David Lawler of Axios, Joyce Karam of The National, and Sean Donnan of Bloomberg News. We welcome your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories. Comment on our Facebook page where you can watch our video stream. Tweet us at 1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. Before we continue, I'd love to get your thoughts on Michael's email. Michael writes, Erdogan gave assurances to Trump that our Kurdish allies would not be attacked in their phone conversation. When Bolton asked Erdogan to put that in writing, he resisted. Trump considers Erdogan's word his bond and will hold him accountable if he doesn't hold true to his promise. What about that, that the President Trump would hold Erdogan accountable if he doesn't hold true to his promise not to attack the Kurds? Is there any truth to that?
I mean, we don't know what happened in the call because we don't get readouts from the White House anymore about who Trump is calling and what they discussed. So it's Bolton's word versus Erdogan's, who is telling the truth. Did Turkey really pledge to protect the Kurds? It's really an awkward situation. I mean, you know, as journalists, we always used to get transcripts. We got readouts of who is the president calling, who is he meeting, what are they discussing. This is just a new norm in Washington, and it's just not doesn't help. And, you know, discussing, explaining these things. For I don't think the Turks ever committed to protect the Kurdish militants that they actually view as terrorists. And their whole pitch to Trump is that we would just go, you know, fight ISIS and not essentially protect the Kurds.
Or maybe to put it more simply, Enhanced Vibes wrote on our website, the1a.org, a verbal promise from Erdogan is to be trusted? No.
Yeah, look, this fits with the theme, which is that Donald Trump feels very comfortable in his relationship with a lot of strong men around the world and is willing to take them at their word in a way that previous American presidents have not been.
Let's talk more about Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The announcement about Syria follows what had been a nonstop week for him. He's been in the Middle East, visiting 9 countries in all. Only 4 of those 9 countries have U.S. ambassadors in place. We're at the midpoint of this Middle East tour, Dave. It wraps up next week. How is it going so far, generally speaking?
Right. So and I think it's interesting that he's going over there to try and reassure people around this Syria withdrawal. He's saying we're not going anywhere in the region. The U.S. has a role to play. And he said in his speech essentially made a big case for a robust U.S. presence in the Middle East. At the same time, he's there because we're pulling out of Syria. Right. So there's kind of a dissonance there. And so I would say it depends who you ask. Maybe the Israelis are a bit reassured when Pompeo goes over there and says, hey, whatever happens here, we're going to make sure that your security is protected. I think other people in the region just, it seems to me they're confused by what the U.S. posture is.
So it wouldn't be wrong to assume, Dave, that this is a bit of a high wire act for the Secretary of State right now.
It's not an easy task to go to 8 Middle Eastern countries or however many he went to and try and explain a policy that has never been laid out clearly by the president himself.
Now, things got a little personal yesterday in Egypt. The secretary spoke at the American University in Cairo, and he called out President Obama for a speech that he had given, that Obama had given in that same spot in 2019. In Secretary Pompeo's words, the age of self-inflicted American shame is over. Listen.
We've rediscovered our voice. We've rejected false overtures from our enemies. And look at what we've accomplished. Under new leadership, America has confronted the ugly reality of radical Islamism. On President Trump's very first trip abroad to this region, he called on Muslim-majority nations to, quote, meet history's greatest test to conquer extremism and vanquish the forces of terrorism.
That was Secretary Pompeo speaking in Egypt, in Cairo, and the President Obama speech was in 2009 rather than 2019. Why did Secretary Pompeo go after President Obama? What's the thought process there, Sean?
Well, I think it's old school politics to a certain extent, but he was really breaking a taboo there. I mean, the American presidents and their representatives in the past have not criticized their predecessors on foreign soil. There's been a view that politics ends at the border once you leave the United States. We've seen that through presidential campaigns in the past and so on. So, that you know, that was another way in which this administration was kind of breaking precedent in the past. There's also a kind of a tone here that is really interesting, and it gets at the whole America First foreign policy that we see in this administration, which is this claim that it is restoring America's standing in the world. There's a lot of polls out there that show that America's standing in the world right now has taken a big dive under Donald Trump.
Although I think it is, Joyce, fair to say that there are some core differences between the Trump administration, the Obama administration, including the way that they've used military force, for example.
No, absolutely. And I think, Pompeo, what he wanted to do is turn the page on the Obama years, give what he called his new beginning. The problem is I don't think he succeeded at that. He was just addressing the Arab governments. He wasn't addressing millions of people in the Arab world. There was no economic message. He didn't mention human rights once. He mentioned Iran 31 times. I mean, this just give you a sense who was the audience from the speech. And given the very partisan tone that he took to Cairo, I think this would have been a speech that's more fit to give from Washington or New York or you name it. I don't understand why he had to go all the way to Egypt to give a speech that would rebuke the Obama administration. It just doesn't make sense.
Speaking of Egypt, there's a story regarding Egypt's president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, that caught our attention. Here's a little rule of thumb. If you're ever doing an interview, for those of you who've never been interviewed, particularly on a national program, assume that everything is on the record unless explicitly agreed otherwise. And that agreement has to be between you and the reporter. Apparently, that was news to Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi because he gave an interview to Scott Pelley for 60 Minutes. But then his government tried to prevent that interview from airing. Now, that didn't work. But if you watch the interview, it's easy to see why they tried.
Do you have a good idea of how many political prisoners you're holding?
We don't have political prisoners, nor prisoners of opinion. We are trying to stand against extremists who impose their ideology on the people. Now they are subject to a fair trial, and it may take years, but we have to follow the law.
Mr. President, the organization Human Rights Watch says that there are 60,000 political prisoners that you're holding today as we sit here.
I don't know where they got that figure. I said there are no political prisoners in Egypt. Whenever there is a minority trying to impose their extremist ideology, we have to intervene regardless of their numbers.
That was Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi speaking to Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes. Did anything, David, come out of this interview that was new? Does this kind of deepen the existing perception of President el-Sisi? What was the impact of this interview?
Well, just to mention another rule of thumb, since you laid one out earlier, I think if you're an authoritarian leader and you're going on 60 Minutes, you should expect some pretty tough questions.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe he doesn't watch on Sunday evenings.
Go back and watch some of the old Mike Wallace interviews, yeah, and you'll figure that out.
So I don't know what he expected from that interview. I think it's a segment in which, if you watch it, you will not feel sympathetic toward el-Sisi and his record on human rights. And there's some real questioning in the segment of whether the U.S. should give as much aid to Egypt under Sisi as we do now. So I think there was no news broken in that interview, but it was something that if Americans are tuning in, they'll have perhaps not very pleasant view of who Sisi is.
Interesting. Go ahead, Joyce.
But as a tactic, I mean, this is typical authoritarian playbook. I mean, you know, for a guy who has gone far to limit freedom of expression and social media debate in Egypt, it would be expected from him to send his officials and contact CBS and say, we're not comfortable, do not air the interview. I think to what David is saying, he did not realize he is actually addressing CBS, and the move completely backfired. But if you know, you look at the broader picture, it just very much fits with his tactics and how he deals with his own media, and that's very unfortunate.
Although, Sean, it's kind of fascinating. You've got this el-Sisi interview, which is just the latest. You had Nora O'Donnell, who interviewed Mohammed bin Salman on 60 Minutes not too long ago, and that interview got some criticism as kind of a way to sort of sanitize his image. You have that classic Mike Wallace interview, where he interviewed Ayatollah Khomeini and asked him about Anwar Sadat calling him, "Forgive me, Imam," his words, not mine, "a lunatic." So there's kind of a place that these interviews have with these kinds of authoritarian leaders who are trying to build a bridge to the West, but there have been so many of them, you'd think you'd have known the playbook by now.
Yeah, you know, the other side of the playbook is, you know, to be a dictator, you got to have plenty of ego. You've seen this through the decades. Dictators thinking that they can be different this time around, that they can take on 60 Minutes in a way no one else can. I think, you know, there's one other interesting tidbit in this story. Something that one of the presidential tweets from Donald Trump that we missed this week was praising el-Sisi for opening the biggest cathedral in the Middle East this week, and he said President el-Sisi is moving his country to a more inclusive future. That's clearly a different one from the future that el-Sisi was confronted with in the 60 Minutes interview.
Let's talk about the border wall. Biggest story here in the U.S., for sure. There was the president's midweek address to the nation, his address from the Oval Office, to try to gain more support for that wall. We've been hearing about how the speech went down here. And by the way, if you are directly impacted by the government shutdown, we would still love to hear from you. We know that there are some of you who are federal employees across the country, or you rely on certain federal services that are affected by the shutdown. If you have stories to share, and thanks to those of you who already have shared your stories, which we know are hard to share and often hard to hear, we welcome more of your stories over the weekend, so feel free to leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. We know how the speech went down here. Dave Lawler, I wonder what your sense is of how it was received elsewhere, whether there even was an audience beyond the U.S. for this speech, or whether this was kind of mostly intended for domestic consumption.
I think it was intended for domestic consumption. There are some really quite stirring pictures of migrants on the other side of the border watching this speech live on laptops and gathering around and seeing it. And I think it was Al Jazeera interviewed a few of them, and they said that they were personally insulted and horrified by it. Obviously, this sort of rhetoric does not play well in Central and South America. You've seen ratings of the U.S., opinions toward the U.S. decline in that part of the world largely due to this rhetoric. I think Trump would say, I don't care what they think of me, I care what people in Kansas think of me or what have you. But this is not the kind of speech that's going to go over well outside of the U.S. borders.
It's actually discouraging, you know, as an immigrant myself, to hear this rhetoric coming from the administration. I was just in the Middle East, and people are very reluctant to apply to visas. They don't know if they would get, just even tourist visas to the U.S. Those applying applying for green cards, there is a lot of anxiety. Is the system still in place, or is it now an anti-immigration wave, legal and illegal, to just you know, keep immigrants out of the border? So this is, I think, the risk that the president is willing to take, and it's not playing out that you know, well for the U.S. standing abroad.
Sean, what about Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador? Wonder what your sense is of his reaction to this. We already know that Mexico has made it really clear that they're not paying for the wall. Some of Mexico's previous presidents, I think including Vicente Fox, were a little bit more vivid in the way they described how serious they were about not paying for this wall. But how is this playing out, you know, in Mexico? Are we hearing more rhetoric from his president, or is he just kind of letting this be a U.S. concern?
Well, so it definitely is a Mexican concern. It's high on their agenda. AMLO, as he is known, just argues it's the wrong approach. He argues that the better approach is to focus on economic development and to kind of help lift up these economies that are generating a lot of the people heading north towards the U.S. border down in Central America. He had a wonderful reaction to the speech, I thought. When he was asked about the wall, he said, "I don't even want to mention the word. It's an issue that's not even on our agenda. I don't even think about it." And then talked about just how wrong he thought it was as an approach, saying, "We will persuade him, convince him that we need cooperation for development. This is the best way to face the phenomenon of migration."
Now, many of the migrants and refugees who are seeking asylum in the U.S. come from the Northern Triangle countries in Central America, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. We had a larger conversation about that on the program this week. You can find that online at the1a.org. But speaking of Guatemala, this week, Guatemala's President Jimmy Morales acted against the United Nations Anti-Corruption Commission that had been deployed in his country. David, we don't talk much about Jimmy Morales, but this caught a lot of people by surprise. What is it about this that raised more concerns about his administration?
Right. So this anti-corruption mission has been active in Guatemala since 2007. So it's a longstanding mission there. The president, the current president, Jimmy Morales, actually came in after his predecessor resigned because of corruption that was dug up by this group. But now it's turned on him. His son and his brother were both charged with corruption-related offenses, and he's about to lose his immunity from prosecution because he's stepping down as president later this year. So it seems to me that that's perhaps why this came to a head now. But interestingly, he kicked the investigators out of the country, and then the country's Supreme Court, Guatemala Supreme Court, said, actually, you can't do that. So there's some wrangling going on still over this. It's not over yet.
Now, the southern border is one of many touch points in the world where migrants are trying to move across borders. But again, we welcome your stories about this border crisis and the shutdown. You can leave us a voicemail anytime, 855-236-1A1A. Dave, let me stick with you because the Mediterranean Sea is another one of these fault lines. And late last year, there were 49 African migrants. They got stranded at sea off the coast of Malta. They tried to make this very dangerous crossing. Malta's Prime Minister, Joseph Muscat, allowed the migrants entry into Malta after 19 days of negotiating with other EU countries. Why is Malta, in the, of all places, this little country near Sicily, why is Malta in the middle of an immigration fight?
Part of it is that Italy is now turning away migrants when they show up on Italy's shores. Nobody that's in the sort of line of fire, if you will, is willing to take in these migrants that get stranded at sea and that are brought on shore by humanitarian organizations. This just underlines the fact that there's no agreement in Europe what to do about this. And Italy's interior minister, Salvini, has actually railed against this agreement, which saw eight countries sort of split up the migrants. He says it shows weakness and it'll encourage further migration. Obviously, there are other countries that view this as a humanitarian crisis and are maybe a little bit more willing. But nobody has come to a solution that everybody in Europe can agree to. And we're going to keep seeing this until that happens.
Much more to discuss on the Friday News Roundup with David Lawler of Axios, Joyce Karam of The National, and Sean Donnan of Bloomberg News. Kansas Patriot writes, "Yesterday, Trump said, 'I find China, frankly, in many ways to be far more honorable than crying Chuck and Nancy. I really do.' How's that trade war with China going for you, Mr. President?" We will talk about China, both with trade and with its dealings with North Korea. And we'll get to more of your questions and thoughts in just a moment. Stay close. Before we get back to the roundup, a quick heads up about the next meeting of the 1A Movie Club, our first meeting of 2019. This coming Tuesday, we'll review the buddy comedy The Upside. It's a remake of a recent French film based on a true story. Bryan Cranston and Kevin Hart play a wealthy quadriplegic and his unlikely caretaker.
Alexa, stop!
Hey.
What?
I'll get the shower ready.
I want that on.
No, man. Look, I get you trying to block out the world, but can you at least do it to better music?
Have you ever listened to opera?
Yeah, opera's really big in prison. You could hardly get a seat on opera night.
The Upside hits theaters nationwide today. We will discuss it when we visit KPCC Public Radio in Los Angeles on Tuesday. If you go to see it, give us your review. How many stars out of five and why? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. How many stars out of five and why? 855-236-1A1A. We will review The Upside, spoilers and all, and share some of your reviews Tuesday on 1A. Back now to the roundup with Sean Donnan of Bloomberg News, Joyce Karam of The National, and David Lawler of Axios. Still time to get in some more of your questions and thoughts, 1A@WAMU.org. Let's talk China. This week, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un made a surprise three-day trip to China. It's his fourth visit to China in a year. Joyce, do we have any sense of what he and China's President Xi Jinping said or did or focused on during the visit, or do we just know that he visited?
I mean, the three-day visit, seems from the reporting, has focused on economics, on infrastructure, on investment, the Belt Road. And I think this is, you know, an important case where China is trying to gain more leverage in any talks that North Korea would have with either its neighboring countries or with the U.S. and, you know, giving China's increasing influence in North Korea. This was also a message for the Trump administration that any deal with North Korea might have to go through China, given their economic influence and deepening cooperation at the moment.
Yeah, with regards to that, President Xi said that he would like to see the U.S. and North Korea hold more summits. How likely does that look, particularly if China is asking for it? Does that affect the likelihood of it happening? Sean?
Yeah, I mean, so Moon Jae-in, the South Korean prime minister, said himself that he thought after this meeting that there was more likely that Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un would be sitting down again at some point soon for a second summit. President Trump himself has
raised that. You mean South Korean president.
South Korean president, right. My apologies. Of course, President Trump himself has talked about the possibility of a second summit after the Singapore meeting last year. There's still huge questions over what sort of deal we're going to see on nuclear disarmament on the Korean Peninsula. China's a big player in that, and China's also sees some leverage that it has not just in terms of the North Korean talks, but also in terms of its broader trade talks with the United States.
Yeah, let me stick with you on that, Sean, because the U.S. has been in talks with China. Negotiators spent about 3 days trying to find an end to this trade war. Did anything come out of that meeting? Did they make any headway?
So we got some warm noises from both sides. I think what we need to stress is warm noises. And, you know, and I cover trade for a living, and we look for warm noises, and that's a good sign.
What is a warm noise?
It usually comes in and says, "There's been great progress." You know, it's a kind of anodyne statement, but it's a sign that things are still going on. And the fact that they're talking is the important thing here. The fact that these were actually mid-level talks is really important here. This is the first time you had what looked like real trade negotiations between the two sides. Beforehand, if you think about this, it's been kind of higher level, cabinet level meetings that really haven't been negotiating the kind of nitty-gritty stuff that you get and the really kind of boring stuff that you get in a lot of trade agreements. This is not, we haven't seen a deal here. We haven't seen the ultimate warm noise, if you will. But we are going to see some Liu He, who's one of Xi Jinping's top economic advisors, coming here to Washington at the end of this month, probably for some talks with Bob Lighthizer, the U.S. Trade Representative. Maybe Xi Jinping and Donald Trump will sit down again at some point soon. So we're moving in a good direction in terms of resolving this trade war?
Of course, my puerile little mind is thinking about warm noises with trade talks, what that would be. I'm thinking Barry White, like, yeah, take those tariffs off, baby, or something like that. Because there are still tariffs on the table that are supposed to take effect in March. China's still causing trouble in the world economy. You know, Jaguar Land Rover is cutting about 5,000 jobs in the UK. Ford says it needs to save billions of dollars. It's planning to close plants in Europe. So there's still trouble on the horizon if these warm noises don't turn into deals.
Absolutely. And yeah. A lot of these warm noises that we're hearing out of Donald Trump are aimed at calming financial markets. And they're not necessarily linked. You know, we saw over Christmas a big collapse in Wall Street that kind of ruined a lot of Christmases. The issues here are insanely complicated. And one of the features of 2019 is that in 2018, if the trade wars were launched, in 2019, we're going to learn how damaging they were. And we saw that with Apple earlier this month announcing for the first time in 15 years a decrease in its profit expectations. We've seen big automakers this week, like Jaguar Land Rover, talk about the impact of the slowing Chinese economy on their business. We need to remember that the U.S. economy and the Chinese economy are really interlinked in a way that is kind of hard to get your head around. But GM today sells more cars in China than it does in the United States. That means if the Chinese economy slows, it's going to hurt 401ks that are invested in GM here in the United States.
Let me bring Joyce and David back into the conversation and shift gears to talk about some of the stories involving the press around the world. We've been having a lot of conversations on several roundups about press freedom, and for good reason. Two Reuters reporters will remain in jail in Myanmar. They had appealed for their freedom, and that appeal failed this week. Wa Lona and Jia Su'u were sentenced to 7 years in jail after they were convicted of breaking the Official Secrets Act in Myanmar. Along with two other journalists, they broke a story about a massacre of 10 Rohingya men by the Burmese military and Buddhist villagers in Rakhine State. David Lawler, is there any hope that these men will be freed or that Aung San Suu Kyi might be able to have some influence here?
Well, this is another sign that we shouldn't be too hopeful about this case, I guess. It's worth reading the last report that these two reporters did. It's available online. And, it's really important reporting, and that's why they are now in jail in Myanmar. And so I don't know much about the court system in Myanmar, but I have a feeling it's not going to decide this case on the facts. And so maybe we should be worried about what the outcome is here.
Now, this week also marks 100 days since the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist from The Washington Post. A Saudi prosecutor is seeking the death penalty for 5 of the 11 suspects who were linked to that killing from October 2nd of last year. Joyce Karam, I wonder what our sense is right now of where the trial stands and, frankly, whether it's a credible process.
We don't know much about the names of those who are standing trial or it's not an open trial. There are no open trials in Saudi at the moment. The U.S. has called for, more credible, more transparent trial. That hasn't happened. With Jamal was a former colleague when we were at Al Hayat. It's very humbling. It's very symbolic to see the solidarity that he has been getting on 100 days, to see the Washington Post, carrying his cause and making it, a global story right now. If you look just not across the Middle East, across, you were mentioning Myanmar, Nicaragua, other places, there is an assault on, freedom of expression. And at a time, when the U.S. government is not exactly championing this cause, it's good to see journalists themselves or media or activists speaking in solidarity, whether with Jamal or other cases.
Sean?
For those of us who have worked in countries like Myanmar, have worked in the Middle East and in Asia and reported in authoritarian states, it's always humbling to remember that there are people who put their lives on the line every day. It's also so maddening how quickly we sometimes forget about these tragedies. One of the most depressing stories I saw this week was the fact that the Saudis were able to go back to the bond markets, and sell $7.5 billion in international bonds to international investors who, 3 months after the death of Jamal Khashoggi, didn't even charge any kind of premium on that. There was no sign that this had actually caused any second thinking by or second thoughts by, you know, international capital markets about this.
Literally business as usual.
The Saudis have weathered the storm.
Another press freedom story that I think you mentioned, Joyce, had to do with journalists in Nicaragua. They've needed to file in secret as Nicaragua's president, Daniel Ortega, continues to crack down on his opposition. Newspapers, other media outlets have exposed brutality by government and paramilitary forces, but media offices have been raided by the police, journalists have been beaten and arrested and otherwise threatened. There's a similar story out of Nigeria. Military personnel showed up this week at the headquarters and other offices of the Daily Trust, which is one of Nigeria's largest newspapers. According to CNN, two journalists were detained because the army said they published a story that put soldiers' lives in danger and shared classified information. Now, David, we've kind of gone through this in the U.S. in terms of prior restraint of newspapers. It was one of the things that came up with the Pentagon Papers. But talk about this case in Nigeria and what the political environment's like right now over there.
We're heading into a presidential election in Nigeria. Buhari, the current president, ran on a security platform. And so what you have is a newspaper reporting on the security situation not going particularly well. In this case, it was an offensive against Boko Haram, who had taken certain areas in Nigeria. And so I think we should be pretty skeptical of the idea that this has only to do with military secrets, given the political environment, as you mentioned.
Can we back up to Nicaragua, Joyce? You had mentioned them. Can you give us a sense of what role the press has been playing there, particularly if they've been pushing harder on Ortega's government and that's prompted more repression? Like, how is that playing out right now?
I mean, they are trying to push, as you mentioned, they're working in secret, trying to uncover some corruption and other stories. But I don't think it's an easy task, especially for us journalists sitting in Washington, to be in their shoes, to work under Ortega, who has been consistent in his assault on freedom of expression. I think it remains to be seen how this plays out, but it's not pretty.
One more story out of Africa we should note. Congo has finally announced the results from its election, which had taken place on December 30th. The winner took a number of people by surprise. Félix Tshisekedi was declared the winner on Thursday. He's the opposition leader. As we said, that took some people by surprise. But David, what was it about that surprised people?
So the backdrop to this election is that Joseph Kabila has been in power for 18 years in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's clung on to power after his term should have ended. Finally, we had delayed elections, and his preferred successor was up against two opposition candidates, one of whom, Martin Fayulu, was expected to be the stronger of the two opposition candidates. Ultimately, when the results were announced, the other opposition candidate was declared the winner, leading to speculation that Kabila may have cut a deal. Basically, don't investigate me. Let me keep what's mine. I'll step aside. You can be president. Now, I don't have that firsthand. Obviously, that's just rumblings. But there is no reason to be particularly credulous when it comes to election results in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Internet was cut off after elections because of rumblings about what the results were going to be. So this is an area where there's not a lot of trust. But I did hear from one expert that say people might be so excited to see Kabila go that they won't react so negatively at the idea that these elections may not have been credible.
Although there had been some hopes, David, that this would be a historically democratic transfer of power for Congo.
Congo has never had a democratic or peaceful transfer of power in its history. And so this is a landmark that Kabila is stepping aside. And yet there's plenty of reason to think that he's not stepping aside in a democratic format that would stand up to European standards, say.
Before we get to our last story, if we could back up to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo for a moment and the Middle East trip that he's on. Can anyone give us a sense of kind of where this goes from here, you know, what his next steps are, what the final deliverables are? I wonder how we assess the success, failure, you know, mixed results of his trip through the Middle East and what it means going forward for the administration? What should we be looking out for in the days and weeks to come?
Joyce? I think right now he's in Bahrain. He announced he's going to host an Iran summit in Poland in February. So Iran is a big issue, trying to bring a coalition from the Arab states to counter Iran. We'll see where that goes. He's also attempting to heal the Gulf Rift, the dispute with Qatar. But we also saw a few days ago that the envoy to Qatar has resigned before even Pompeo stepped foot in the GCC countries. So it doesn't seem he'll gonna get much on that front. And again, you know, there's so much uncertainty about who speaks for the U.S. president. Is Pompeo, reflecting the U.S. decision-making when he talks about Iran or Yemen or Syria or others?
One last story before we go. I'm going to put an earworm in all your brains, because there's a preschool favorite that you know what I'm talking about that has hit the Billboard Hot 100 charts. It's Baby Shark. It debuted on the charts this week at number 32. Stay with me on this one. Stay with me. Because this infectious little song that comes with very cute choreography is the creation of Pinkfong, which is a South Korean educational brand. The YouTube version of Baby Shark has been viewed more than 2 billion times, and it's inspired many parodies. James Corden did one on The Late Late Show. But the song came out in 2015. The remix has been out since 2016. So why is it hitting the charts now? Maybe it's the rise of K-pop, maybe just a fluke, or maybe pop culture is finally paying attention to the onesie-wearing crowd, which it's about time. With that earworm in your mind, I say a heartfelt thank you to David Lawler, the World News Editor for Axios. David, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
Joyce Karam, Washington Correspondent for The National. Thanks, Joyce.
Thank you.
And Sean Donnan, Senior Writer at Bloomberg News. Thanks, Sean.
Thanks to Baby Shark.
Turn it up for just a little bit. Let's just hear it in there. One A senior producers are Lindsay Foster Thomas, Danielle Knight, and Gabe Bullard. You can learn more about our entire team online at the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Enjoy your weekend. We'll see you Monday from Los Angeles. This is 1A.
Say that last do-do-do-do. Safe at last, it do 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 do. Safe at last, it do 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 do.
Safe at last,
you.
It's the end, it do 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 do. It's the end, it do.